Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Do you think today's social media questions are all new for the 21st century? Does it promote or threaten freedom and democracy? Does it broaden or just coarsen the public square? Does it connect us to other human beings or isolate us from them behind our screens? But a new book argues that these questions have been asked before. The book is called Writing on the Wall, Social Media, the First 2,000 Years. Author Tom Standridge is known for many of his previous history books, including A History of the World in Six Glasses and others. He is digital editor at The Economist and editor-in-chief of Economist.com, and he joins us now to discuss social media from ancient Rome to your smartphone right now. Tom Standridge, thanks for coming on WNYC today.
Thanks very much.
When we say social media today, obviously we're referring to things like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn. But the premise of your book is that thousands of years ago, there were similar social platforms. Really?
Yeah, my basic argument is that you don't need a digital network to do social media. So the really important thing about social media is that it's media you get from other people. It's people passing stuff from one person to another along social networks. And this allows you to have a sort of sense of distributed community, a discussion with people who aren't physically there, but over a wider area. And this is very different from the sort of one-way broadcast media of radio and TV and newspapers. This is two-way and conversational. And it's been going on for thousands of years.
Papyrus rolls, Roman messengers.
Yes, it first arises in the Roman era because in order to have a social media system, clearly the participants in that system need to be able to read and write, so you need a certain amount of literacy, but it also needs to be cheap to deliver and copy information. And today it's cheap for us because we have the internet, but in the late Roman Republic, this is the first century before Christ, it was cheap for Romans, or at least rich Romans, because they had slavery. So slavery was the Roman broadband. It meant that they could have documents copied and delivered at little or no cost to them, and that was what they did. So we see these letters whizzing between Cicero and Caesar and their contemporaries, and they're discussing the political news, the social news, and the two are mixed up because the Roman elite is a group of intermarried families. So the social gossip is very much overlapping with and the same as the political gossip.
And so today's social media is much more populist, for one thing, right?
Yes. I mean, one of the clear things we see over the long history of social media is that each subsequent improvement in technology from the printing press up to the internet has made it go faster. And also steady improvements in literacy and education over that period have made it more accessible to more people. And we're really coming to the end of this process, actually. In the next 20 years, the spread of the internet in developing countries is going to mean that it's soon going to be possible for anyone in the world who wants access to this global publishing system will be able to have it. And in fact, I think literacy is going to prove to be a bigger goal than technological impediments. But essentially, we are getting to the point where anyone who wants to participate in this massive two-way conversation will be able to do so.
A minute ago, you distinguished social media two-way or multi-way communication from the one-way street of mass media, which, as you write in the book, arose with the steam-powered printing press and broadcast radio and television. So do you see the industrial era as a temporary interruption in a larger flow of media history?
Yes, essentially, I think the mass media era, which we're used to thinking of as old media, as the way sort of media always was, I think it was actually an anomaly. If you look at the last 2,000 years, media was social for most of that period. But what happened in the 19th century was that these new technologies were invented that allowed people to reach large audiences very efficiently, but they were very expensive technologies. So newspapers at the beginning of the 1800s in the US, for example, were quite small. They had a circulation of maybe 1,000 copies, and most of what was in them was actually written by the local community. It was letters and speeches and things like that. What happens during the 19th century is that printing presses, steam presses, allow you to print 1 million copies of a newspaper a day. And then, of course, in the 20th century, you get radio and TV. These are very, very efficient for reaching millions of people, but they're expensive pieces of equipment. Not everyone can afford to have one. And so we get this centralization. We get these large corporations emerging that essentially control the media, and the governments often are involved in that as well. And so you get a very, very small priesthood of journalists and broadcasters and politicians who get to decide who gets to use this gear. And what's happened in the last 10 years is the internet has made reaching a large audience extremely cheap, almost free. And you can, you know, put something out there, and who knows, you know, it may go viral and reach an audience of 10 million people or whatever. But the point is, we have examples of this every week. The woman the other day who resigned from her job made a video saying how dissatisfied she was, and you see her dancing around the studio where yes. she works. That went crazy. And it wasn't because a newspaper editor or a TV network said, oh, we're going to make this woman famous, let's do it. It was because the internet decided that they thought this was cool. And this phenomenon of the audience amplifying what it thinks is worthwhile is social media.
So let's talk a little bit about how social media affects public discourse. What you gave is a very inspiring example, but the criticism is that social media encourages uncivilized discourse because of the anonymity of posting a comment on a website, or that it's just easier to be rude to someone who isn't standing in front of you, or by the ignorance of the masses, which, you know, thinks it opposes Obamacare but supports the Affordable Care Act, and it can spread as if there was a distinction between those two things. Did the fear of erosion of civil discourse arise at earlier times historically too?
Absolutely, yes. And we see it in particular, say, when the printing press appears. It suddenly becomes much cheaper to print things. And so not, that doesn't mean everyone does it, but we see things like Martin Luther uses pamphlets very effectively to argue against what he sees as the corruption in the Catholic Church. And even at that point, so he's writing these short, easy-to-read pamphlets. They cost about the same as a chicken. So they were actually affordable to people, whereas buying an entire Gutenberg Bible was like buying a car, it was, you know, or a house. It was amazingly expensive. And we see his contemporaries, like the great intellectual Erasmus, saying, well, you know, this is terrible. People are reading these pamphlets when they should be reading the classics, and they're not reading the great big Greek and Roman authors anymore. And then later on, we see attempts to clamp down on printing by various countries in Europe. And once again, the printers pop up and say, well, you can't just have anyone printing anything. That'll be terrible. Why don't you give us a monopoly and let us censor everybody else? And of course, they have very self-serving reasons for saying this. So essentially what you get is this argument that you have trivialization of discourse every time that publishing gets easier. But one man's trivialization is another man's democratization. And I think we have to remember that in previous periods of history, whenever there has been this outpouring of new stuff being published by new people, we haven't just had complaints that the wrong people are saying the wrong things, which is what we have now. We've also had a response to that, which is new techniques have been devised to figure out what the good stuff is. So things like tables of contents and book reviews and indexes in books, they were all ways of dealing with the fact that there were a lot of books out there and you couldn't possibly find the good bits efficiently. And I think we're going through the same process with the internet now. That the tools are getting better, starting with Yahoo directories and then Google search and now these sort of social search hybrids. And the idea is to allow us to find the stuff that's relevant to us and good for us and sift the signal from the noise. And the important thing is my signal is going to be different from your signal. But we're still at the beginning of that process. But yeah. Yes, this idea that this is all, you know, the world's going to the dogs and we should only let certain people use these things is an argument we've heard before.
Did you see that one of the science magazines has closed its comments page entirely because it doesn't want actual scientific information and debate to have to compete with unscientific rants about the content from the untrained?
Yes, I did see that. And one of my responsibilities at The Economist is to look after our website and its comment threads. And I think that this is not the way forward. I think we need better tools to... So we, for example, allow people to upvote what they regard to be the most valuable comments. We encourage the journalists to respond in the comments and so on. I think you can have a sort of greater level of discourse. People in my field sometimes call it the adult in the room effect. If you tell people what the rules are and as with a small child, you say, look, here are the rules and you have to not step over them. So I think you can police forums and I think you can allow users to sort of help you vote up the best stuff and vote up the best commenters. And I think you don't need this kind of black and white approach. You either allow it or you don't. There are ways of doing it and there are ways of doing it well.
Tom Standage, author of Social Media, The First 2,000 Years. And I want to touch on social media and revolution. Because as you explain in the book, social media played a role in the French Revolution, the American Revolution, social media as you define it in the context of those times, and the Reformation. Martin Luther was a social media expert, literally writing on the wall with his famous posted letter. But you say that those revolutions probably would have happened without social media. People have said a similar thing about the recent events in Egypt and elsewhere. So can you discuss the role of social media in both the historical revolutions and the more recent ones?
Absolutely. I think what social media does is the idea that it's, you know, a trigger of these things is clearly not the case. There's an underlying grievance in each case. So it was, you know, corruption of the regime in the French Revolution. It was unhappiness with the British and the lack of democracy in the American Revolution. In the case of the Reformation, Luther is unhappy with the Catholic doctrine of indulgences, the way that it's being expressed. And in the Arab Spring is all about high unemployment, lack of opportunities for young people if they don't have the right connections, rising food and fuel prices. So these are the underlying grievances. What social media did in all of these cases, both historical and modern, was it allowed people to determine that other people felt the same way that they did. This is something media scholars today call synchronization of opinion. But if you're a fan of Martin Luther's and you're spending your money that you might otherwise have spent on a chicken to buy his latest pamphlet each few months when one comes out, you go to the printer in your town. And what happened was that the printers would print 1,000 copies and they'd spread to the next town, and then those printers would print them and so on. And Luther wasn't paid for any of this. It was just sort of the audience spreading his message. And if you went to your local printer and said, have you got the new Martin Luther? And he said, well, I had some yesterday, but they've all gone. Then you knew that lots of people in your town felt the same way about the Catholic Church that you did. And we see this again with the Arab Spring, that activists put up pages in support of members of their groups who had been beaten by the police or murdered in some cases. And people would like those pages and they would pretty soon be taken down. But if they attract 80,000 likes in an hour, that tells you that other people feel the same way that you do. So it's this ability to recognise that your opinions are held more widely that does this. And in fact, Martin Luther says it beautifully. He says, from the rapid spread of his writings, the 95 Theses, I gather what the greater part of the nation thinks of indulgences. So in other words, the rapid spread is itself a signalling mechanism. So I think the way to think of this is that social media doesn't start revolutions. It's not the spark that starts the fire. It's the accelerant that allows the fire to spread more quickly once it's got going. And that's what we've seen both in the last few years in the Arab Spring, but it's also what we see in history.
And before you go, just help us make a segue to our next segment, which is going to be about the demise of New York City's largest graffiti mecca, Five Points in Queens. You may not even have ever heard of it, but you write that graffiti was an important part of social media in ancient Rome. It was the original status update.
Yeah, we see some hilarious things in the Pompeii graffiti. You know, today I made bread. We see the equivalent of sort of TripAdvisor reviews. People would write reviews on the outside of taverns to tell you if they were any good or not and say, actually, this one's terrible, go up the road. And we also see sort of call and response messages. One of the interesting things about graffiti in the Roman period was that because people were so proud of their literacy, writing on the inside of someone else's house was actually accepted because it showed that you and they were literate. And so we see some lovely examples of what look like Facebook threads where people are trying to outdo each other in their wit and their banter. And this is written on the shared stairwell of an apartment block in Pompeii. So
literally writing on the wall. We have virtual writing on the wall today. You're talking about literally writing on people's walls.
That really was. And we see campaign posts. It really is an insight into the whole of Roman society. So, yes, this idea that graffiti is always bad, you know, there can be very good uses of it then and now.
Tom Standage is the author of Writing on the Wall, Social Media, the First 2,000 Years. If you want to see him in person, he'll be at the Tribeca Barnes & Noble Wednesday night at 6 p.m. That's the 97 Warren Street Barnes & Noble in Tribeca, Wednesday at 6 p.m. Tom, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And folks, who owns the graffiti at Five Points in Queens? Coming up next, why a judge will have to rule on private claims to public art. Banksy, are you listening?